the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour this Monday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Great to be in your company. Very soon we will get to the results of the Australian Wool Innovation Election. Was it a vote for change? Also in the next half hour, the challenges facing the red meat sector as some consumers turn their backs on meat due to environmental and welfare concerns. Plus, later in the program, we'll take you to Pinery, where hundreds have gathered for a memorial 4 years on from the devastating bushfire.
Hundreds of hours of volunteer work gone into this, so it's invaluable, really, as the result we've got here is just so much well worth it. So many people have come back to where they grew up. So many people are connections to the victims of the fire, or purely came into the district as the response to help people recover. So they've all come together and it's been a real good catch-up, basically, and reflect moment.
That story coming up after the weather on the Country Hour. But first today, wool growers have voted for a change at the top of levy-funded company Australian Wool Innovation. After a heated campaign, two fresh faces have joined the board. Dr. Michelle Humphreys, a veterinarian based in the Riverina, and Victorian sheep breeder and corporate director Noel Henderson. But many wool growers were surprised to see former chair Wal Merriman fail to get back on the board. Josh Becker has more.
I declare Dr. Humphreys, Mr. Webster and Mr. Henderson to be elected as directors of the company, and their appointment to the board will take effect immediately. I congratulate all three of them.
After a bruising campaign, the vote took longer than expected and surprised some wool growers, with former chairman Wal Merriman missing out on a spot on the AWI board with more votes against than in favour. The result came as a shock to Robert Ingram, wool grower from Delegat and representative of the Australian Wool Growers Association.
I'm very surprised by the result. I think it's a clear statement for us to all move forward.
And what is that statement?
That statement is that let's just move on. We've had a long period of where there's been intense discussions about how the industry should move forward and where it should move forward. We've now got two new really good candidates on the board.
Wal Merriman wasn't successful in his bid to be re-elected to the board. What's your view on that?
People have obviously looked at what's happening and made a decision, a very clear decision. I mean, it's the first time ever that somebody's been removed from the board by getting more against votes than for votes. That's a precedent. And so people have clearly spoken.
Wool Producers Australia Ed Story says the result reflects a mood for change and wants to see the industry now come together.
There was a large number of votes today for change, in the way the company does business, in its attitude to its shareholder and levy payers, and in the way it needs to collaborate more with other parts of the industry and work together.
You say that it was a vote for change, but two of the candidates were backed by AWI, both Michelle Humphreys and David Webster recontesting his position on the board. So there is that continuity there. Was it a complete vote for change, or what are you pointing towards there?
Oh, look, I think if you take the votes, and in all the other candidates, there are a lot of shares wanting for change. But true, David has been on the board for a number of years now and has been re-elected. We congratulate him for that. Michelle's a new candidate, so we look forward to her input. I think she brings good scientific knowledge and veterinary experience to the role. So we congratulate her, and we welcome Noel Henderson on the board, who's got very significant business experience and should be able to bring some real punch and deliver really good outcomes for shareholders. So, look, this is over now. The election's been had. We need to all move on, and we encourage the board to work in a collaborative way with all aspects of the industry and all sectors of the industry, because we all want the same thing for the industry. So let's hope we move to that shortly.
The big headline that people will take out of this is that Wal Merriman was unsuccessful. He had more votes against than for in his bid to get back onto the board. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, well, look, you know, it's a democratic process and the shareholders have spoken. You know, Wals served the wool industry with distinction over a number of years, particularly early on, but his time on the board has ended. We thank him for that and we wish the new board all the best.
Colette Garnsey has been re-elected as chair of AWI. She says the democratic process on display at the AGM shows the company is working well.
Well, I was very happy with the meeting, Josh. I'm very happy that the democratic nature of the company is working. Our shareholders had a say in how they want the company run. They had a say on the constitutional matters, and we were pleased that that was passed so resoundingly with a good vote. And I was very pleased that we had a robust process with the independence testing, etc., with the independent BNC to have those nominations. The result of the election will be will enable the company to have new ideas, fresh perspectives, and I think will be very good for the company. I was pleased with the meeting.
So does that mean it's been reflected with a mood for change from growers with two new board members to the AWI board?
I think it's great to have renewal. It's also great that we've got the continuity of having Director David Webster return to the board. You know, that's terrific from a corporate memory perspective, to give us the history and to make sure that, you know, that we do get that transfer of knowledge. So I was pleased with that, and also pleased to, you know, see that we've got a great range of skills on the board. So the directors that have come onto the board have a terrific range of skills, which will really add to the performance of the board.
That's the chair of the AWI board, Colette Garnsey, ending that report from Josh Becker. Well, there's two AWI-backed candidates, a couple of new faces. Was it a vote for change? I'd love to hear from you today, 0467 922 783 if you'd like to send us a text. Or you can also call. The number is 1300 222 891. Was it a vote for change? Are you happy with these results? Wall's gone. There's a lot to discuss there. 0467 922 783 if you'd like to have your say. Now, South Australia's Dr. Janelle Hocking Edwards was vying for a position on the board but wasn't successful. I spoke to Dr. Hocking Edwards earlier and she says she's disappointed with the outcome, but it's time for the industry to unite and move forward.
It's the beginning of change, which is good. Michelle Humphreys is also new on the board. She hasn't been on the board, but she was endorsed by the people that were already there. But she is new, so that's two new faces on the board. And it's also a female, which is good to see a female replacing a female. Might have been nice if there was another one on there, but that's the way it goes. So, yep, as I said before, the shareholders have voted and that's what we've got to work with.
And David Webster he's the one person that was re-elected. Now, I know that you've sort of raised concerns about David and Wal Merriman in the past. What do you make of that decision?
Yes, it's disappointing that the board haven't changed or attempted to change the suggestion of the review of performance to limit tenure on the board to 10 years. So it's disappointing to see that wasn't brought into effect, and the outcome of that is that somebody who's been on the board for a significantly long time remains on there for who knows how long.
A lot has been made about, you know, voting for change, and like you said, there are two new faces there. Do you think that's enough now that we're going to see a new era for AWI?
It's a start, and also I think with the awareness that change is needed, the people that have been elected might be looking at that change, trying to change the culture of the board, trying to open up the research, be more accountable and transparent. So, I mean, one of the positives of running this is just increasing awareness of what needs to happen. So hopefully those new directors will be able to take that to the board.
Now, Wal Merriman wasn't successful in his re-election. What's your take on that?
Once again, the shareholders have voted for what they saw was the most appropriate people for their board. The shareholders have made that decision, not me.
Do you think, though, I mean, there was a lot of talk around him at the time. Do you think it's just sort of people are now ready to move on? I mean, he had more. It was the first time I think someone wasn't re-elected because he had more against votes than for votes.
Yes, that is unusual. And the whole, from my understanding, the whole system of voting for and against is quite unusual. As you said, I think it's the first time somebody has had more against than for votes. So probably a pretty strong feeling about what should be happening. And it's a very unusual form of electing people as well.
And on the flip side of that, you actually had the least amount of against votes. Do you take anything from that?
Yes, that's very positive. I'm the least disliked person. So, I mean, that's positive. And I was also extremely happy with the number of votes that I got. I'm so grateful for the number of people that supported me. And as I've said, I'm really, like, there were so many people supporting me quite loudly, and also lots and lots and lots of people working in the background who raised my profile and were affirmative for me. So, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's been a really interesting, really, really interesting experience and a learning experience. And so, like, even though I'm disappointed with the outcome, I've certainly learned a lot, and my awareness has increased as well. So it's all been good.
What do you think needs to happen now moving forwards?
And now the industry needs to try and unite and work together and work with the board that has been elected get the industry moving forward. It's a wonderful industry. Wool production is wonderful. We need to try and raise that positivity and get wool seen in a positive light and not a negative light and inside bickering. I mean, that would be the best outcome.
That was South East sheep producer Dr. Janelle Hocking Edwards. 0467 922 783. If you'd like to have your say, was this a vote for change? Are you just looking forward now? What do you think AWI should be focusing in on now? 0467 922 783. If you'd like to have your say, it is currently 17 past 12.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, now for a warning if you're buying stock feed. The demand for hay continues to escalate, even more so now that fires have wiped out remaining pastures in some areas, so fodder like hay is at a premium. And competition for that fodder is said to be resulting in unethical behaviour from some suppliers, bringing a note of caution from New South Wales Government's Drought Transport Subsidy Integrity Advisor, Derek Scone.
We're starting to receive some complaints again of gazumptings, so people that have either had verbal or written contracts to purchase hay from merchants or private traders, and when they go to take delivery, they've been told that it has been sold. So this is very disappointing that on the back of the problems that we had last year, it's re-emerging this year, and especially now that the bushfires have taken out a lot of country, they're using that as an excuse. So we would like people to morally stand by the contracts that they have made with individuals and not try and get a higher price if that's the case.
So if people have a verbal agreement, or if they've, you know, made phone contact with someone and then they're proceeding on the basis that, you know, they've got an agreement with somebody, what recourse do they have if that fodder then turns out to have been sold on to someone else?
Well, a verbal agreement is a binding agreement, and people should be aware of that, that if you do make a verbal agreement, if you do renege on that, that is an enforceable contract, and the best course would be to make a complaint to Fair Trading. And if Fair Trading get enough of complaints against one individual trader that is consistently doing that, then action will be taken. But we just hope that it doesn't have to come to that. That it, you know, people will see that people are doing it tough. Number one, with the drought, and now with the fire damage that has occurred across a lot of the eastern seaboard New South Wales that you know, that people sort of act responsibly and ethically in relation to hay trading.
Now, if you have made a verbal agreement with somebody, what proof do you have, though, that you have done that? Is a diary note, for example, is that sufficient to back up your statement that you have a verbal agreement with someone?
Look, I think you have to check with the Department of Fair Trading that actually what can constitutes a verbal agreement, but I think diary notes would very well be, and phone records would be required to verify that.
It does leave a bad taste in your mouth, doesn't it, at a time when the state is in such a bad way, both through drought and then with the additional pressure of these really horrific fires in the north and in other parts as well, that people might be looking to profit from this?
That's right, and you know, it's only a quick buck profit, and I have to look at the future, because you know, if you do tarnish your reputation as a trader, then in the good times, then you will be bypassed, and you know, fodder will be sourced from other people. So I think the long-term picture is what people should be looking at, and you know, respectful traders will always do better in the long run.
What is supply of fodder like in New South Wales at the moment?
Look, currently there is quite adequate supply, but I would suggest that if people do do their sums and require fodder, that they start looking around now, because there's a fair bit of fodder that has been purchased straight off the baler and is not being warehoused on the producer's farm. So coming down the other day, down the Newell Highway, I pulled into Narandra, and there were 6 B-doubles in the service station there full of hay. So there is an enormous amount of hay that is moving currently, and a lot of that is straight off the back of the baler. So I think if people do their sums and work out what they need, currently would be the best time to purchase fodder.
Now, the other thing that I've heard recently, and I'm in the Riverina at the moment, I'm hearing that there have been haystack fires.
Yes, well, look, there was a very large one down in Bendigo about 10 days ago, where $1 million worth of hay went up. So under drought conditions, there is always this problem with high sugar content in the hay, and that leads to cereal hay, especially if there's a little bit of moisture, that it actually can spontaneously combust. But it's not only hay that has been baled to green or prior to being fully cured. It's also, if you do get a rain event, because of that high sugar content, any water that leaks into the bottom of the bales or comes in through the top through a leak in the hay shed roof or something can lead to spontaneous combustion. So it's important when you buy hay to monitor it. A good way of monitoring it is early in the morning, having a sniff around, because you can smell it when it's starting to cook, or putting a rod into the into a number of bales, so like a quarter-inch rod that's sharpened. The old saying of put a crowbar in, but unfortunately the bales are that dense nowadays that you can't get a crowbar in. So just a quarter-inch rod with a T-handle and a sharpened point, and you put that in sort of 500 to 600 centimetres into a bale, and then pull it out after about 10 minutes, you'll get a very good indication of the temperature inside the bales. And it's important to monitor the hay, because it only takes one bale to set a stack on fire.
That is former New South Wales Farmers President Derek Scone. He is currently the New South Wales Government's Drought Transport Subsidy Integrity Advisor, and he was speaking there to Sally Bryant. Well, we know that the Australian red meat sector is facing challenging times ahead, with tension growing around healthy diets, veganism, and plant-based proteins. So how do producers and processors keep their beef, lamb, and goat on the menu? And how do they also increase the appetite when some consumers are turning their backs on meat due to environmental and welfare concerns? Those were the questions producers and researchers delved into at this year's Red Meat Conference, hosted by Meat and Livestock Australia. Here's its Managing Director, Jason Strong.
What we've got to do is make sure that we're not in a position where we're trying to build that trust or relationship with our consumers and our customers just because somebody's been militant or aggressive or offensive about saying or doing something. We need to have built a trust bank where when those things happen, people look at it and they, you know, cock their head and say, well, that's interesting, but I know these other guys are actually doing the right thing, and I know that they're committed to solving and managing the issues which are of concern to us.
One operation sharing their provenance story across the world is Argyle Food Groups, a vertically integrated operation from breeding, fattening and processing to the sales, marketing and distribution of its red meat. Based on the southwest slopes of New South Wales, the operation supplies the domestic market and exports to multiple markets around the world. CEO Lachlan Graham says a range of technology is used to share product provenance as far and wide as possible.
We've developed an on-farm livestock production software system that we actually monitor every animal, where it came from, its entire lifetime cost basis, what diet it was on. So it's almost like a by animal P&L, and then we actually link also the MSA grading. So all the animals are processed, that data comes back, and then we actually then integrate that into the distribution and the marketing and the actual, almost like the front office of the brand, where the consumer is actually scanning it on a pack. That then scans it up onto their phone. They can then see the story. We can then help them advise how to cook that product, how to, you know, utilise it, what sauces to pair with it, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's a big part of the whole, I suppose, verification and provenance of the brand and the product.
Those gathered at the Red Meat Conference explored another key component of selling red meat, better understanding the customer and what is a continually changing and complex marketplace. So to keep red meat sizzling in Aussie kitchens, MLA has invested in research around consumers and learning more about what they think, feel and want. Some of that research includes what MLA states as world-first shopping research, with virtual reality used recently to see how customers behave when they shop for meat. Here's domestic market manager Graham Yardy.
For us to break through all that noise and tell our story, and tell a story that is significant and remarkable to them, it is challenging. And so we have to find those remarkable stories. We have to find those things that are relevant to them, that do meet their needs. You know, they want to know about, well, how great is this going to taste? What is the quality going to be like? And how is this going to make their life easier, number one?
He says the restaurant space is another important place to engage consumers.
You know, we want people like chefs, that they might be going to their restaurant to talk about the product and how they see it, you know, and from a perspective. And they're like an independent body, right? You know, they're the types of people that can really influence, you know, how people shop and how people dine.
When it comes to producers, expanding opportunities for your product when consumer demand is constantly changing is not easy. For Emily Pullen from southern Queensland, she and her family found a way to unlock new high-value products for their beef. Her family are cattle producers turned jerky makers, and Emily says value-adding in the red meat industry is another way to engage consumers.
I would embrace the fact that more people would be looking at ways that they can value-add onto their product. And whether that's snacking or whether that's finding a niche market for a branded product, it's a way of looking at something. You have a finite resource, you know, we only ever have so many cattle. What's the best way that I can find the best place to sell that? And looking at the market and where can I see a space that I can actually make an impact with the product? And I think the more that people start thinking more widely and diversely about beef, the more exciting it is for the sustainability and the ongoing profitability of our sector.
Graham Yardy adds there is also more room for industry transparency, with less than 40% of Australians having ever been to a farm.
Taking them through the full supply chain from paddock to plate and showing, well, this is the reality, this is what happens. And, yeah, fantastic, you know, Australian red meat, it doesn't just happen. As much as a lot of the properties and a lot of the land that we use is fairly wild and is not great for really growing anything else, there's a lot of work that goes into the feed and the pasture management and managing those natural resources that the, you know, the producers are custodians of and which they take very seriously.
That is Meat and Livestock Australia's Graham Yardy, ending that story from Lara Webster. And you can read more online at abc.net.au/rural. And, yeah, less than 40% of Australians have been to a farm. That sort of makes things a bit, difficult, I guess, if you're trying to have that that conversation. Well, let's go to the dairy industry now, because a controversial section in the latest version of the Dairy Code between processors and farmers looks set to be deleted. Farmers have been outraged that the code in its latest wording seemingly allowed for controversial clawbacks in prices by processors. However, after a meeting with the Federal Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie, the CEO of Farmer Power, Gary Kerr, says he has assurances that that clause and other parts of the code will be reworded or deleted.
Oh, well, we met with Bridget McKenzie on Thursday, and we went through the mandatory code. We outlaid to her our concerns about the current state of the code and the way it's being interpreted. She made quite clear to us that one of the major clauses, which has been causing a lot of problems, which is beyond reasonable control, would not be within the mandatory code, that she will address that issue and she will make it quite clear that that's not the case at all. You know, look, we'll wait and see. We'll see what comes out in the mandatory code. She did say, you know, right from the start that, it's gone. That was her comment. It's gone. Don't worry about it. We will fix it.
Yeah, so just to be clear, you have an assurance from the minister that the ability for processors to drop prices in circumstances that were, quote, beyond reasonable control will be taken out of the mandatory code before it's put in place by government.
Her words to her was, it said it was gone. So she said they will clarify the position on those couple of clauses that are impacted by that, and she will ensure that it reads properly. So that was her comments. She definitely said to us, in her own words, there will be no clawbacks.
And the code will still be in place by next milking season?
Well, she's hoping by the 1st of Jan, which was what she's now come back to saying, even with indications it's going to blow out, but you know, beyond that period.
And you're comfortable with that?
Well, I'm comfortable for coming in before by the 1st of Jan, as long as those main issues have been addressed that a lot of organisations have raised with them. I don't think there's anyone that hasn't raised those concerns. Like, there's a lot of other concerns too we've raised, like about the inequity and the penalties and things like that. But we've got to have a starting base. So if we can get the mandatory code 90% correct to go into effect by the 1st of January, then we can address that other 10% as the things progress. As I pointed out to her, there is a review mechanism within 12 months' time. I told her it is important we get this mandatory code in, even if it's not perfect, because we can address those small shortfalls in 12 months. But we at least need to have something working as we're talking.
How long have you been trying to get a meeting with the minister for?
Since she was made Agriculture Minister.
And this was the first time you got to speak to her?
This is the first time we've had to engage with Bridget McKenzie directly.
You recently called for her to be sacked. What was the temperature of the room like?
Oh, look, she was aware that, in fact, I even stated, you know, that she would be aware that I called for her to be sacked, but I think maybe it opened the doors. And she realised that there was other opinions out there besides what she'd been getting that she needed to listen to.
That is the CEO of Farmer Power, Gary Kerr, speaking there to Warwick Long. It is after 12:30 on the Country Hour. Let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Luke Redford.
Good afternoon, Isabella. A 12-year-old boy is one of eight people charged with several driving offences following a police pursuit at Port Augusta at the weekend. Police were alerted to a BMW doing burnouts on Cook Street and Paringa Road on Saturday. Investigations revealed it had been stolen from Marino a few days earlier. An initial search failed to find the occupants, but yesterday police arrested eight youths between the age of 12 and 16. Five will face the Port Augusta Youth Court today, with the rest bail to appear in the next month. The federal government could bring on a vote on its union-busting legislation this week after months of negotiations with the Senate crossbench. Labor, the Greens and the unions have been campaigning against the bill to make it easier for unions to be deregistered and their officials to be disqualified from holding office. The coalition believes it has the support of the two centre alliance senators and is close to securing the votes of One Nation. Opposition leader Anthony Albanese says it's a seriously flawed proposal. And five South Australian scientists have joined together to urge politicians to lift the ban on genetically modified canola crops. The scientists are calling for the ban to be lifted to allow farmers to access new technology to better deal with climate change. The ban, which is supported by the opposition, is likely to be debated in the coming weeks. And we'll have more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Luke. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to head to the Riverland to hear how the region's date harvest is going. And we'll also take you to Pinery. There was a memorial there yesterday, 4 years on from that bushfire. So that is still to come on the Country Hour. But right now, let's head off to the Weather Bureau. And it's good afternoon to Senior Forecaster Simon Timke.
Hi there, Isabella.
Now, it looks, I'm looking out my window and it looks like it wants to rain, but I'm not getting my hopes up.
No, you've summarised it perfectly. It's trying hard to rain and the radar does look pretty busy with it, but it's very dry in the low levels of the atmosphere and it's evaporating before it reaches the ground. So most of that that you can see on the radar is what we call Virgo, which is rainfall that doesn't reach the ground. There has been a little bit that's made it to the ground down in the southeast. Robe Aerodrome has had 0.8 of a millimetre since 9 a.m. this morning. Cape Jaffa has had 0.4 and Mount Gambier 0.2. But generally speaking, I think it'll be a struggle to get much on the ground, and anything that that does would be less than a millimetre. Further to the west, we've had some isolated thunderstorms. We had one just sort of over Lower Eyre Peninsula earlier this morning. There's been a couple of very isolated strikes up that way. And a little bit more further to the northwest, out west of Tarcoola there, there's been a few thunderstorms this morning as well. No rain gauges out there, so not sure where there's been much on the ground. Maybe a spot or two, but again, similar to here, I think, where mostly it's probably evaporating before it reaches the ground. The change itself is moving across Western Eyre Peninsula and Kangaroo Island as we speak. If you can imagine a line roughly from about Woodna down to Corney Point and then across the far eastern part of Kangaroo Island, that's roughly where the change is now. We've had some pockets of quite strong winds in the northwesterlies ahead of that change. Both Woodna and Minipa got pretty windy immediately ahead of the change, sort of blowing the order of 35 to 45 kilometres per hour. And the temperatures sort of in some of those pockets have been getting up into the low to mid-30s. So still fairly significant conditions from a fire weather point of view, even though we've got this cloud over the top and the temperatures aren't getting quite so high. So I expect that as that change moves slowly eastwards, we'll see those northwesterly winds pick up and the fire danger increase as the winds pick up and the temperatures increase a bit as that trough approaches. So the fire weather warning that we issued this morning for Eastern Eyre Peninsula, Flinders District, Mid-North, Mount Lofty districts, we're still keeping a pretty close eye on conditions in those districts as the change moves across. Conditions much cooler behind the change. Temperatures have sort of dropped into the low 20s and the winds have turned around southerly and pretty fresh there as well. We do have a marine wind warning out for some parts for those southerly winds for Spencer Gulf, Gulf St Vincent and the Adelaide Metro waters for those southerly winds strengthening behind the change once it moves through. So a couple of warnings out there, the fire weather warning and the strong wind warning for those coastal waters. By late this evening, that change will be right up in the far northeast of the state over the northeast pastoral district to the northeast of Lee Creek there. As it moves across those inland parts, could be a bit of blowing dust, could be an isolated thunderstorm over the northwest pastoral and Eyre Peninsula, and it'll continue to try and rain out of it, but I think we'll struggle to get much on the ground out of that as we sort of discussed earlier. By late Tuesday morning, the front will have cleared to the east of the state. We'll have those moderate to fresh southwest to southeasterly winds extend throughout the state. Could still see a little bit of dust northeast of Lee Creek to start off with, as those southerly winds will be pretty fresh to start off with. But I think by afternoon, mostly that risk will have decreased. Early morning, there could be a shower or possible thunderstorm north of Lee Creek over both the northeast and northwest pastoral districts there. But again, by late morning, I expect that risk will be gone. Further south, mostly dry conditions as the next high becomes established over the bite there, and conditions, the winds ease and the atmosphere stabilises. But still just a chance, a slight to medium chance of a shower about the lower southeast district. And there's quite a bit of cold air pushing up that way as well in behind today's front. So before sunrise tomorrow, possible there could be a bit of small hail around the lower southeast district as well. And then into Wednesday, that high moves slowly eastwards, so we'll have light winds and clear skies across the south to start off with on Wednesday morning. So a bit of a cold start on Wednesday morning. Chance there could be a little bit of frost over inland parts of Southern Eyre Peninsula, the mid-north, inland parts of the southeast districts and the Murraylands as well. We're sort of getting to that time of year now where it's a bit of a struggle to get the temperatures low enough for frost, but I think in those places where we do sort of get a bit colder, it's not impossible, but it will be fairly short-lived and probably only a light frost, but worth keeping that in mind for the grape growers in particular. And then through the end of the week, Thursday, Friday, we'll see that next high develop southwest of Perth, and there's a front that sort of slips away over waters to the south. So we'll go into an onshore airstream over the state. Generally speaking, a slight chance of showers over the west and south of the state, becoming a little bit more likely about the southern agricultural area Saturday, Sunday and Monday, and about southern coasts on Friday. Chance there could be a thunderstorm right up in the far northwest of the state on Thursday and Friday. And with those southwesterly winds, particularly sort of Saturday, Sunday, Monday, that's probably the highest likelihood of showers, particularly over the southern agricultural area. But that chance of a shower is extending over the northern agricultural area and the far south of the pastoral districts as well. And we'll go into a much cooler airstream too for the weekend and Monday, with those south to southwesterly winds being pretty fresh at times and keeping conditions on the cool side. As far as any rainfall totals go over the next few days out till midnight Friday, generally anywhere that picks up any rainfall, I would expect it would be less than 2 millimetres, but a slight chance there could be 2 to 5 millimetres near southern coasts and in the far west with some more likely showers over those areas. But that's about it from us for now, Isabella.
Thank you very much, Simon. Simon Timke there at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now, and for the Upper Western District, tomorrow is going to be a hot day, partly cloudy with a slight chance of a shower in the far east in the afternoon and early evening. There'll be areas of raised dust and the chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. Now, there's also going to be strong winds, 30 to 45 kilometres an hour during the morning. Overnight, it'll drop to between 17 and 23, and then during the day, it will warm up to between 27 and 37. For the Lower Western District, a partly cloudy day tomorrow with a slight chance of a shower in the morning and early afternoon. There'll be areas of raised dust and the chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. And again, there'll be strong winds at 25 to 40 kilometres per hour before dawn. Overnight, it'll drop to between 11 and 19, and then a bit cooler for you there during the day, reaching the mid to high 20s. It's coming up to 17 minutes to 1.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
You are listening to the Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Great to have you with us this Monday. And it's been 4 years today since the Pinery Fire tore through the Lower North. The anniversary falls just days after serious bushfires destroyed homes on the York Peninsula. This year, a special memorial has been unveiled at Grace Plains near Malala to remember the two people who died in the fire, as well as reflect on how the community has recovered. Cassie Huff has more.
The golden wheat crops near Malala show few signs of the fierce fire that raged across 85,000 hectares and destroyed 90 houses 4 years ago today. But the community remembers, and yesterday more than 350 people met at the new Moki Lea Pinery Fire Memorial to reflect on the last 4 years. About $100,000 has gone towards rebuilding the shed to house information about the region and remember Alan Tiller and Janet Hughes, who died in the fire. Pinery farmer and one of the memorial organisers, Derek Tiller, says the community has really come together to show their support for the memorial.
The community's really turned up. The CFS has really made it something by putting at least 12 fire units on display over here and bringing all crews with them. The site's been well prepared with the tent donated by the RAA there, and we estimate maybe we had 350 people at an early estimate.
And can you tell me the work that's gone into this event?
Well, we've been working on this site for 4 years. It was completely ruined after the fire. The tennis shed was a ruin, and so was the old cricket pavilion. We've gone about recladding those with donations from others. We've tidied up the cemetery. We've reduced the size of the site, so there was a cricket pitch, a football pitch, just on the side of the site here. That's been reduced back to a maintainable size. And now you see in the sheds here, we've got metres and metres of display item for the historical record that we wanted to have here for the memorial of the Pinery Fire, a tribute to the local history of the community, and what's there to remember the two victims of the Pinery Fire, and also to the life of the Private Fred Nan.
Who this area is named after, I understand.
That's correct. The site's called Moki Lee. That's an Australian interpretation of the Battle of Moquette Farm in France, where Private Fred Nan lost his life. He was a local farmer, and that's where the site came about from donations from locals to create this site in his memory in the first place.
What has rebuilding this site done for the community?
I think it's part of moving through the recovery process of the fire is creating this somewhere for people to go and remember what did happen. It helps us move on a little bit, that we feel like we've contributed back, and now it's a record here for others to consider. And they'll take fire safety seriously, and they might have their bushfire plan for the next catastrophic day.
There were about 350 people at the event. A lot of people have stuck around to tell stories and things. What sense have you got from them for the day?
I think they're all really enjoying a reunion. So many people have come back to where they grew up. So many people are connections to the victims of the fire, or purely came into the district as the response to help people recover. So they've all come together, and it's been a real good catch-up, basically, and reflect moment.
Where to now for the community?
I think get on with their lives and just remember this. And I think that it was really well said today by a couple of them to just remember to be good to your neighbours. They'll be good back to you, and just enjoy the community that we've got here, because it is special, and because you can see what it's produced here and the way it's recovered from the fire. Who'd want to leave?
Moki Lee trustee Derek Tiller speaking there. Alan Tiller has also been remembered by the Owen Ag Bureau. In 2018, a crop competition was created in his honour. Agronomist Michael Brome explains why.
What we wanted to achieve was that we would actually remember him and bring up his name and talk about it and get together as a group and talk about Alan and the day that he was taken. And we thought a wheat competition that would give us an opportunity to drive around in spring and look at all these fantastic wheat crops, and then we would announce the winner of the wheat competition over our annual dinner meeting that we have in August, and that gives us a good opportunity to talk about Alan and at the same time benefit the whole community, because we're looking at crops and critiquing them, what they could do better and to improve on their crops. So improving production whilst remembering Alan.
Given the last 2 years haven't been particularly crash hot seasons, how's it gone?
Look, it was really good. Like, it's the tough years that really the good farmers, the good crops stand out. So it's actually quite easy to judge in a dry year. So, and this year we joke that there needs to be of course, the winner, the best crop for the area, best fences and fence lines and management and cleanest and best quality and yield for the year. But also there's been quite a lot of frost around this year that's really hammered crops. So we thought there should be a second prize as well, or like the best frosted crop. So, it might have been managed really well for weeds and pests and diseases, but it's been cruelly wiped out with frost. So we haven't come up with a prize as of yet, but we are thinking about an ice cream or icy pole or something like that to really signify frost and Yeah, it was quite brutal this year.
And as part of these awards, you particularly want to bring Alan into it. How's that?
We've got a perpetual trophy made up, which is made from burnt fence post and wire from the fire ground. So that's the, you know, the physical bit. And then, to be part of the judging criteria, we tried to weave in as much Alan things that Alan used to do, funny things that Alan used to do, and we called this, which was worth half of the points, so it was judged out of 100, and, you know, we had weeds and disease and yield and all these sort of things factored in, but the other 50% was all about Alan factor. So Alan was renowned for falling asleep in meetings, and, if you're coming to meetings and falling asleep, you know, that's you know, another way to remember Alan, or, you know, anything silly that Alan might have done, it was good to remember. Good way to judge it as well. So, and it's really hard to separate good crops, so we needed something, you know.
And who did win the overall Owen Crop Awards?
The inaugural winner for the Alan Tiller Memorial Wheat Competition was the Low Quality Hay, so the Low family, based out of Worsley's.
That is agronomist Michael Brome speaking to Cassie Huff at the Moki Lee Pinery Memorial event at Grace Plains near Malala yesterday, speaking just there about the Crop Award in honour of Alan Tiller, who died in the Pinery fire. It is 10 minutes to one.
The South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
We're going to head off to the Riverland now, because driving around the Riverland recently, you may have noticed some date palms with some extra accessories. Now, protective netting is a key aspect of being a date farmer, and Grace Whiteside caught up with a grower to understand how it all works.
I'm at Steve Brewer's farm in Garra Garra, and he's taking me through the process of netting his date palms. He shows me how to tie the branches together so a bunch of young dates hangs down, and he covers it with a green mesh bag. He uses a cherry picker to reach the higher branches.
Yeah, at the moment I'm looking at tying down the bunches with hopefully a good fruit set. So until I get up there and check, we won't know, so we better start. Yeah, first of all, you've got to pollinate them and hope for a good fruit set. Then you've got to go through and bag, tie them down, and then bag them. Like a fine mesh bag, protect them from the birds and the weather conditions.
How long does it take?
Bagging? Oh, well, depending how many bunches you've got. You might do a couple hundred bags a day if you really get into it.
For someone who's never seen a date palm before, what does the bunch look like?
Well, it's on a long stalk, and you might have anywhere from 60 to 80 strands on that for the flower. And on those strands, you might have anywhere from 4 to 20 plus pieces of fruit. All about, let's say, the bahi, a small locust size, or it would be a good comparison, or a big cherry size.
So at the moment, they're yellow strands with bright green baby dates.
Yep.
What's the process from here until harvest, and what does it look like when they're ready to pick?
Well, from here to harvest, once I've bagged them, then it's just keeping the irrigation up to them, fertilising. Harvest time, from those green fruit, which are probably, small 5-cent piece size at the moment, you're looking at, say, a big 20-cent piece size later on, all yellow, and you pick them in a whole bunch, hopefully, in one hit. Of course, wages, you want to try and minimise costs, so if you can pick them in one hit, it saves a lot of time and money. Then you put them into the box and set off to market, and hopefully there's a good return. At the moment, yeah, there is a good return, but fingers crossed that stays quite away for a few more years.
Do you have to replace the bags at all during that time?
No, you leave the bags around the bunch for the whole season. Well, the ones I got them purchased from China. They were 50 cents a bag, and I think, right, even if they only last 1 year, it's still economic compared to $5-6 from bags imported from Israel. But these bags, I've had these coming on to be fourth season now, so they're looking good for another year. Depends on what the birds do. Last year, we had the emus get into them and rip. Well, what's the word for it? Ripped them to pieces. Emus being inquisitive.
What other birds do you get?
We got the green parrots that the local parrots. They just sit there. I think it's more, they're not liking the fruit, they're just inquisitive and can do a lot of damage if you allow them to keep pinching the fruit.
How is the market looking?
Market's looking good. We can't supply. We get that many inquiries, not just from Australia, internationally. I can't see it happen for my lifetime anyway. So.
And we were talking a couple months ago about some pollination issues, particularly with the bahi date. How's that looking now?
Well, we've still got that pollination issue, but with my situation, I think given that one more year and a bit more fine-tuning the nutrients, but I think that's where we've got to look at in the fruit set, is try and get that nutrient balance right. And at this stage, there's no knowledge base in Australia for Australian conditions. And that's, as the association, we're trying to work out, send someone over there to get some knowledge, but then that knowledge we've got to try and fine-tune it for Australian conditions. Our soils are different, our weather's different, so...
Where does most of that knowledge come from at the moment?
I think the majority is from the MENA countries, Middle East, North Africa, and then you've got Arizona with the medjools, California with bahi. That's the main knowledge space.
That is Riverland date grower and chair of the Australian Date Growers Association, Steve Brewer, speaking there with Grace Whiteside. Now, last month, the ABC revealed that hundreds of registered racehorses were being discarded at slaughterhouses in Australia. It was some pretty graphic footage. It breached racing rules, rehoming policies, and animal welfare guidelines. But today, I'm bringing you a story about a former racehorse finding a forever home and a second career. Saskia Mabin visited Sydney and his owners at their stables in Broken Hill.
That's the sound of Sydney. He used to be a racehorse. Now, Cecilia Norley and her daughter Gracie are training him for a second career running barrels.
I first knew about Sydney when his jockey contacted me and wanted me to come out and see him gallop. I arrived early in the morning, just on sunbreak, and I seen him galloping, and from that moment I just fell in love with him and knew that he was going to be a really nice horse for Grace one day. So I had to wait a while because he just kept going fast and he wouldn't slow down to retire. And then we finally came across, you know, but was approached by his owner and asked if we wanted him. So it's been a journey from there.
Cecilia said an old horse can be taught new tricks, but it does require patience.
Well, I mean, racehorses are designed to go fast in a straight line, where barrel racing is, you know, a little bit more calculated in the turning and the speed at different times. So we had to rewind his brain to start thinking how we needed him to.
And how long does it take to achieve something like that?
Oh, it's a bit like how long's a piece of string. We wanted to take our time with him because we wanted to get it right. It's just patience, and you just know once you form the bond with the animal and you really start watching it and understanding where it's at, you know when to make the next move with them.
Cecilia ran a riding school in Broken Hill. So horses have always been a part of her daughter Gracie's life.
Well, usually when I ride, like, a horse, I get on, and sometimes it takes me a month to connect with a horse, sometimes it takes me a week, but honestly, as soon as I seen Sid, I just literally fell in love. He's so kind, and he's really, really brave. Like, he'll approach anything without, like, hesitation. He's just so nice to me, and I really love that, and I love all horses, but he's just got something special about him that I really, really love.
Tell me about barrel racing. What does a horse have to be good at to be able to do well in barrel racing?
Well, there's three turns, and you really just have to have a fast horse, but you also have to know how to get, like, a perfect turn without knocking a drum and without going too wide, and you need to have, like, perfect angles and stuff. And then but I reckon it's just about speed.
That's a lot to think about, and a lot probably for a racehorse to adjust to as well.
Yeah, well, at the rodeos, I think, like, the big speakers and just having a horse with all that big crowd, especially Sid, you know, he thinks a crowd is a race, and now we're going to go to like a rodeo and he's going to see the crowd and hear the speakers and he's going to know to gallop, but I think he'll be perfect to, and he'll know what he's doing and he'll run barrels well.
And you're still at school, right? So how do you balance, you know, racing at quite a competitive level and still managing to be at school full time?
That is so hard. Like, I have to do exams and assignments and try to stay at a level with all the other kids at school and stuff. But it's, I seem to just get home from school and go straight into the arena and ride all my horses. And it's difficult when you have to work multiple horses before an event and stuff and fit in school. But my mum always makes me do my school first. But usually I try and get out to the horses as quickly as possible to get them all work before it goes dark.
He's so affectionate.
He's obsessed with puddles.
That is Gracie Norley from Broken Hill there. You can hear the passion in her voice, can't you? That is all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. It is coming up to news time, 1 o'clock.